This is Alekhine's Defense, an X-Men First Class fanfic written by Sinuous Curve and read by Rena Jenkins. This story is rated G, contains the pairing Eric Lensher, Charles Xavier, and takes place in the span of time after X-Men First Class, before the first X-Men trilogy movie. This story was written for the Kink Bingo prompt, Bodily Secretions, contains a character with disabilities, relationship angst, several movie spoilers, and discussions of the 1960s era view of homosexuality. Author's notes. My deepest thanks to Dance and Butterfly for a thorough and helpful beta, and to Sabrina Ill for multiple betas, patience, and insight right when I needed it the most. This was a much different fic when I first wrote it, and if it's any good, it's because of them. Charles senses Eric as soon as he enters Central Park. The students, exuberant to finally have an afternoon away from the school in Westchester, are a giddy presence at the back of his mind. Scott and Alex, brothers reunited at last and slowly learning how to live together again. Aurora and Jean, holding hands and whispering schoolgirl secrets in each other's ears. Sean smiles at the prettiest girls and nearly loses his footing with awkward, half-grown limbs. Charles senses no fear or pain, and hardly any wariness, for a group who find their disparate origins very far from bright lights in big cities. And though he would never cut them off entirely, even in the safety of the school, he does set them aside for the moment as he wheels down 64th Street, toward the glowing spot in his mind. Eric's presence intensifies a great deal long before Charles can actually see him, sitting at a stone table with the chess pieces already nearly arranged in their proper places. It's more than the nominal awareness of an unshielded mind. It's practically deliberate projection bursting forth from Eric. It makes Charles' heart beat faster. And when Charles does finally see him, in the flesh for once, not in a dream, Eric looks less a radical mutant separatist than a banker temporarily displaced from a 50th floor office on Wall Street. He's foregone his preferentially ominous tunic and cape that ought to look ridiculous, but somehow doesn't. And the helmet, obviously. Though whether the omission is intentional or born of necessity, Charles can't say. In a black overcoat and very smart hat, Eric is unbearably lovely. From a distance, Charles watches an elderly man in an old but quite neat suit approach and ask for a game. Eric's refusal is obvious, and obviously polite, from the way the man's shoulders shake in laughter, Charles is too far away to hear. Eric is the only person Charles has ever met who justifies human kindness via the possibility that every person he speaks to could be a mutant who knows very few moments of brotherhood and compassion. The man tips his hat, and Eric resumes his wait. Charles considers whether it is hope or presumption that permits him to assume he is what Eric is waiting for. He pushes his wheelchair forward and sends out a small curl of telepathic power. It's not an intrusion. Charles values both his continued existence and the uneasy truce they have built over the years far too much for a needless betrayal. It is an alert of his presence. Eric's gaze sharpens then, and he cranes his neck to search through the early afternoon crowd. It's a brisk day, cool enough to carry the hints of autumn, but not yet so cold that parents fear to bring their children outdoors. Charles is, of course, hardly inconspicuous amongst the crowd, and wouldn't be even if he and Eric hadn't always been so attuned to each other. He tips his hand in a small wave. Eric stands and inclines his head. The most obvious question is how he knew to be in the park, but Charles finds the answer largely irrelevant. Despite everything, he's not frightened of Eric. He still believes in the basic goodness of all men. Charles pushes himself through the crowd to the table Eric selected. He notes the usual chair has already been removed to give him adequate space. "I must admit," Charles says, as though they are simply old friends, "this isn't the place I would have predicted." Eric raises an eyebrow. "Would you have preferred a seedy motel with a squeaking mattress and stains on the carpet?" he asks, heedless of the small children milling around in the sunshine. "I can return the chess set if that's what you prefer." Warmth flushes at Charles' color. He recalls an afternoon spent in hedonistic laziness in his bed, despite the looming threat in Cuba. Eric, lying indolent and naked on his stomach in the tangled sheets. He asked, "Which do you think is worse to them, to be a mutant or to be queer?" And Charles hadn't an answer, except the somewhat tepid recitation of his belief in all people. "This is fine," Charles says. For a moment, the physical sensation of Eric's gaze is uncomfortably palpable, perhaps a touch vindicated and righteously disappointed. But down that road lies a very old and very raw argument, and a distinction Eric maintains that Charles cannot understand. He straightens, raising his chin. Eric meets his eyes without contrition. Perhaps someday Charles will stop expecting it. "Shall I begin?" Eric asks. "As you've taken white, yes." While Eric considers the board with a level of absorption that Charles does not believe for a moment, Charles searches through the surrounding crowd for any hint of a familiar mind. Angel, perhaps. He doubts he would recognize Eric's other associates as anything other than mutants. Though, if he's honest, it's Raven, Mystique, he wants. She's communicated through sporadic postcards and Polaroids that provide frustratingly fragmented evidence of her existence. "She isn't here," Eric says, moving his knight. He looks up from the board with regret and understanding, and Charles swallows down an unexpected burn in the back of his throat. He's a man, for Christ's sakes, not a boy with a mother's skirt to weep into. Charles moves a pawn forward at random. The truth is, they both enjoy chess, but neither of them is particularly skilled at it. They play while they talk to have something to do with their hands that isn't touching each other. He resists the urge to ask after her, his little blood sister treated rather badly. Eric mirrors Charles' pawn, despite Charles having strayed from the traditional middle pawn at his opening move. There is, perhaps, something a touch poetic in that. Or perhaps it's simply that it is easier for Eric to follow Charles in the meaningless moments. There are bruises on Eric's knuckles, mottled a light green and brown. If only because it has been a very long time since they last saw each other, and because Eric makes Charles restless and reckless. He reaches across the board and picks up Eric's hand to examine the injury. It's old. Nearly healed. And yet, what happened? A small disagreement with a hard surface. Eric lies with a thin smile. Teasingly, he dangles the truth in images at the edge of Charles' awareness. Something about a prison. A dark prison with water dripping from the ceiling and the sudden bright spray of blood against dirty tiles. Charles shuts them down. Perhaps someday Eric will stop expecting Charles to find a vengeful satisfaction in his abilities. May I ask what on earth happened to your hair? Eric asks. With his unoccupied hand, Charles reaches up and smooths his palm almost over the newly naked skin of his scalp. The shave is so fresh, there isn't even the harsh roughness of new growth yet. Truthfully, Charles keeps forgetting he's done it. Hank found that increase in contact with the Cerebro helmet decreased the pain interference caused. I've begun to go bald, Charles lies, moving his castle. I decided not to prolong the agony of the process. Eric nods in acknowledgement, both of the answer and the way things stand between them. They play several random, silly moves beneath the horrified gaze of masterful old men who despair to see their favorite pastime treated so cavalierly, and to the delight of small children at the inexplicable journeys of kings and queens, knights and castles across the board. Charles pays less attention to the game than Eric. It's the smallest things. The crook of his fingers as he picks up a piece, the slip of wrist revealed beneath the cuff of his coat and jacket and shirt, with his skin tints gold in the sun. Charles wishes fiercely that they were alone, so he could chase his observations with touch. Eric is so many contradictions Charles cannot seem to easily reconcile, and yet he still evokes a constant reaction from Charles. After Charles sends his remaining knight careening recklessly into the breach after Eric's king, Eric looks at the board and laughs. Oh, I think you've won. Have I? Charles peers at the few remaining pieces. Oh, indeed. Checkmate, then. With a low chuckle, Eric topples his king. The piece clatters faintly on the weathered stone and rolls towards him. Game to you, my friend. He pauses and looks at Charles with an expression that Charles can't interpret. Now, do you have to scurry home right away, or might I beg another game? The sun is high and warm in the sky, and the students are still an odd presence tucked safely in a hidden corner of his mind, amazed at the city and each other. And really, Charles is not a wise man, but a man who wants. I have time, he says, and Eric nods and begins replacing his pieces on their proper squares. Charles sweeps his black pieces toward him and begins the same task. King and queen standing in the middle, flanked by knights on either side, then the castles and the rooks. Pawns lined neatly in front, though this set has some decorative carving, giving them a proper and forward face. Charles thinks of the board in his study, perpetually caught in the suspended time of a game begun that will likely never finish. It is, after all, Eric's turn. At the table next to them, a young girl drags the discarded chair Eric moved to make way for Charles into place. She clambers up opposite an elderly man, Charles presumes to be her grandfather, with a dark braid swinging halfway down her back. She peers intently at the board with her chin balanced on her fists. Eric glances at her, with his fingertips resting lightly on a pawn. His gaze slides to Charles' wheelchair for a moment, but it flicks quickly back to the board without a word. Charles has always wondered whether Eric takes responsibility for the bullet, or whether he simply blames himself for not stopping it. They've spent more time together in the interim than anyone would believe. Oddly, It is easier to lie in bed together in the dark than to move together. He has reconciled himself to the probability that he will never receive an apology. Your move, Charles says, tipping his fingers toward the white pieces arrayed across from him. Yes, thank you, Eric murmurs, picking up a pawn and moving it forward 2 bold squares. And yours. It is a different kind of game they play the second time around, with a greater precision and thought than before. Passing couples hold hands and peer with distant interest at the games, and families wander past with children in tow, and young nannies push prams with babies nestled safely inside. They are, to Charles, a piece of the humanity he likes best. Proof of the peace that is a possibility Eric refuses to see in bright blue skies and leaves beginning to turn brilliant colors. Charles watches them from the corner of his eye when it's Eric's turn, quietly envying their easy normality. Charles shakes his head and ignores the twist in his lungs. He wants this with Eric. An uncomplicated ease in an afternoon in the park, not hours stolen from beneath the noses of others because before they were enemies, they were friends and lovers. Did your parents bring you here when you were a boy? Eric asks suddenly, lightly. Occasionally. Charles' voice comes out embarrassingly rough, and he hides the moment behind a polite cough. Yes, occasionally. My mother and I would spend weekends in a hotel a few times a year. If there was time, we would come. It was the zoo, mostly. Eric makes a soft sound of acknowledgement. What was she like? Charles opens his mouth to answer, then closes it. He remembers his mother as a distantly benevolent figure, high in her own adult castle in the clouds. After his father died, she retreated away from the rest of the world and went dutifully through the motions. He never dreams of his mother or father, though from time to time the kind, sad face of another mother entirely appears in his dreams. Lighting candles with a man Charles has never met, and a child Charles can never decide if he knows or not. But there's no ease, even in those memories that Eric places in his hand. She was my mother, Charles says, capturing a pawn with a reckless move of his knight into the jaws of Eric's queen. She was neither very good or very bad. I don't think of her much. Eric captures the knight. I know, he says, with a kindness that renders Charles suddenly struck with an anger that he cannot articulate. It would be so much bloody easier if Eric were simply violent or cruel or cast as the villain in their drama. But no, that would be too convenient for a man of his ideologies. Did your father teach you? Charles asks, which is a barbed question he almost immediately regrets. Eric's hand curls into a sudden, white-knuckled fist, and Charles wishes he could bite out his own tongue. No, Eric says slowly, making no effort to hide the slow grind of words from his throat. My grandfather taught me. My father and I used to play at night before bed. Charles takes Eric's rook with his castle and keeps his eyes trained on the weathered stone of the board. It is an uncomfortable sensation to have memories that are not his float upwards as recollections that don't feel as though they belong to someone else. He can too easily see the scene contained in Eric's bitten-off words. The kitchen table of scarred but deeply polished wood, and the light from the lamps turning in the old board a rich brown and yellow. Hand-carved pieces splayed in battle across the squares, and his father's, Eric's father's, Big hands, moving pieces with a soft smile. With each move came sparely spoken words of advice that contained all the secrets of the universe. The quietly spoken German, used to only having meaning in their cadences to Charles. They were the words of a man who loved his child dearly. Years later, he's picked up enough German to understand the gist of it, but the impression of pride and deep affection is still the strongest. It is an image Eric treasures. Charles shakes his head to dislodge the memory and the guilt, and is entirely successful with neither. "Your move," Charles says. There is no point in asking if Eric misses his family, or what happened to the old pieces. He isn't certain he could explain why he knows what he knows. That in the nights they spent together when there was no distance between their skin or their minds, things bled over that Charles never meant to take, and Eric never meant to share. "Yes," Eric agrees. He moves his rook. "Penny for your thoughts, old friend." The rush of possible answers that flood into Charles' mouth startles him, and with that comes a low, humorous laugh. He rubs his hands over his eyes and squeezes them shut. Far better to say nothing than to confess things that cannot be taken back once said. His damned traitorous eyes burn again at the corners, and he can feel the thickening in his throat. He will not make a fool of himself in front of Eric, though damned if he can explain to God or man why he still cares so damn much about what Eric thinks of him. Eric, who made little enough sense when they first met, and has made steadily less as time wears on. The demands he makes are so simple and implicit when they lie together in bed. Be a mutant, be a man, be a queer, and be proud of all these things. There isn't much that's secret between them, except the murky years after the war that Eric has pinned down in his mind with such force that even Eric can't really touch them. It's the impression of a rage so overwhelming that it eclipses everything else, and honed into a fine focus that turned him into the man he is. After all, Eric has endured, while Charles has the world placed neatly at his feet. And thus, he can walk down the street with absolute conviction of his right to live as he is without fear. And still, Charles holds to his anonymity. Charles can admit that sometimes he is grateful for the memories Eric has spared him. He doesn't exactly want to know what it took to turn Eric into Eric, and that, he can admit to himself, is his own failing. It makes him feel very weak, that he cannot even stomach the memories when Eric lived it. No. All he has ever had to do is the rather easy task of accepting Eric for who he says he is. It's not so very much of a struggle. "My life was so much simpler before I knew you," Charles says, using his one remaining knight to take Eric's rook. "Check." Eric arches an eyebrow and uses his king to take the knight. "I might say the same." "I suppose mine was simpler to begin with," Charles counters, swallowing with force to little avail. There is sometimes, with Eric, the urge to apologize for his past, as though his sorry would have any meaning at all, other than as an attempt to excise his own guilt. He inhales a long breath, but the exhale shudders. "But I was content before I met you." "And lying." Charles looks up with sharp, hot, heady outrage burning in his veins, alongside the utterly irrational tears. Eric meets his gaze with a steady resolve that Charles cannot understand, because it isn't as easy as Eric likes to pretend. Not if you like large portions of the world in which you live.
I don't lie.
You omit. Eric eases his knight across the board, then plants his elbows on the table.
You like to read the minds of others. You like to run your school. You like nights in bed with me. But you don't want to be a mutant.
Quite accidentally, Charles makes a noise of caution, and, with a wry expression, Eric lowers his voice.
You don't want to be a mutant or a queer. And that, my friend, my lover, is how you lie. Checkmate.
Charles looks at the board.
Indeed.
He flicks his king over with his first finger and feels a single shameful tear burn down his cheek, because he is an idiot for having come to sit across from Eric when he ought to know better. He bows his head, blinking hard, forcing steady breaths from lungs that don't wish to cooperate with their owner.
Oh, Charles, Eric says quietly. You great fool.
I am indeed, Charles agrees, gritting his teeth against the ridiculous dampness at his eyes.
I should go.
No, wait, Eric interjects, pushing back from the table. His chair ekes out a rough, vaguely torturous sound that Eric ignores as he skirts around to Charles' side. A young man steps forward and asks if they've finished, and Eric nods, offering him use of the pieces as well.
Come, he says to Charles.
And as they've just agreed he isn't a wise man, Charles pushes away from the table. They find a secluded spot, just a bit off the main path, and stop. Charles puts the brake on his chair and pushes his knuckles into his eyes. He hasn't cried in a very long time, with the exception of the day on the beach when he was in terrible pain and slowly seeing the house he'd built unravel in the inexplicable choices of others. Perhaps it's a blessing that it isn't the wild wailing of a child, but rather the tight, unhappy tears he associates with Raven's bad days, when she looked in the mirror and believed no one would ever love her. Eric kneels in front of him. With two fingers, he forces Charles' chin upward so their eyes meet.
We are a little hopeless, you and I,
he says, with soft certainty. With his thumb, he brushes the tears from Charles' face. His hands drift downward to cup Charles' jaw in his palm.
I've never cried in front of you,
Charles says, rolling his eyes upward and blinking hard.
It doesn't help.
At least not like this, for no damn reason. The corner of Eric's mouth turns up in a wry smile.
Well, you've seen me cry for many reasons. I suppose we could call it even now.
Charles manages a low chuckle, shaking his head. He sees the intent in the line of Eric's body, and from the look in his eye, and it would be a lie if Charles claimed there was no muted flare of panic at the thought. They are mostly alone, and Charles hasn't felt so small in a very long time. So he allows Eric to lean forward and kiss both his cheeks and each of his closed eyes.
One day we'll stop meeting like this, unnecessary theatrics included.
Eric shrugs. Without the theatrics, we might not ever manage to meet. I'll take what I can. He turns his head and looks at the sky, then stretches out his hand and looks at his watch.
But time flies, I suppose, and neither of us are without our responsibilities.
Charles nods. He wonders if the urge for resolution will ever lessen. It would be lovely if he believed things could reconcile.
We do. And then it is back to the business of being nothing more than old friends, enjoying an afternoon in the park, as Eric stands. Playing the parts of men who do not run schools for the unwanted children of the world, and men who do not believe very little of the world is at all worth saving. Side by side, they move back onto the main path, amidst the couples and the families and the laughing children. Eric adjusts his hat to a rakish angle. Silent, they walk back towards 64th Street, with the understanding they will go separate ways. Eric, Charles says as they reach the sidewalk.
Yes?
Next time, consider the motel room. He doesn't look at Eric's face as he wheels away, but he hears the laughter. The end. Reader's note. This podfic was recorded for Helen 78. Because she gave me a replacement Sansa clip when mine crapped out, so I figured she should have something to listen to, since she just gave me a listening device. Okay? And I know she likes Charles and Eric, so she gets this. Alright, and everyone else, I hope you enjoyed it as well. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.